So yeah, the last time we talked about assessing causal compatibility of some distribution over the observed variables by trying to do quantifier elimination on all the parameters that relate to the variables that are unobserved. In this lecture, I'm going to start talking about schemes that just avoid altogether talking about parameters that relate to the unobserved variables, but instead sort of stick to attention on parameters concerning the observed variables, but in sort of different scenarios than the one that you started out interested in, where it's sort of easier to derive constraints. So this is the, I mean, that's used in various techniques. There's a result that came out of Perimeter called the inflation technique for causal inference. I'm gonna start with that, and then next time I hope to say a little bit about how it connects to, you know, earlier techniques that use similar ideas, but that are a bit less general. Okay, so I'm gonna start by not talking about causal inference, but reminding you about the marginal problem, which has nothing to do with causal structure, it's just about the structural probability distributions. So this was the example I think I gave in the second lecture, where if I ask the following question, I tell you that the marginal for some, on X and, or sorry, I tell you three distributions on XY, YZ, and XZ. These are three binary variables. So let me just call those the target bivariate distributions. And then the question is, does there exist a distribution over all three variables that has these three things as its marginals? So by PXY here, I just mean the marginal on XY of that three-way distribution. Similarly for PYZ and PXZ, that's the sort of standard notation. And I wanna know, is there any distribution that has these guys as its marginals? And the answer is yes, this distribution here, 0, 0, 1 plus 1, 1, 0. You can check that for X and Y, the first two, you get the perfect correlation. But for Y and Z, if I marginalize over X, I get the anti-correlation. Similarly for X and Z. So that would be an example of the marginal problem, finding that there is a distribution that has those. If I change the example and say, suppose the first one is not perfectly correlated, but perfectly anti-correlated, I ask the same question. The answer comes back, no. One way to see that is if you just look at all the possible eight terms that could appear in the joint distribution over X, Y, Z, you'll notice that none of them have anti-correlation between every pair of variables. Right here, these guys say I need anticorrelation between every pair, but if I look at any one of them, I'll always find some pair that are correlated. Like this guy has 1, 1, so Y and Z are correlated. Here, X and Z are correlated. So at the end, there's no distribution that will give me these marginals. and so in general, you want to know for some, you know, choice. Here's a third example like this, where Y and Z are perfectly correlated, X and Z are perfectly correlated, but now X and Y are uncorrelated. You ask, is there some joint distribution? And again, the answer comes back in this case, no. One way to see it is that if I look at the distribution on YZ, so those are the last two terms here, having only support on 0, 0, and 1, 1 means it can't be any of the three-way distribution cannot have any of these terms in it because all these terms involve anti-correlation between Y and Z. And similarly, if I look at the distribution on X and Z, see, that is perfectly correlated. I can rule out all these guys where X and Z are anti-correlated. And out of all the strings on three bits, the only ones that remain after I rule these guys out are 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. But any distribution over those guys are going to have X and Y perfectly correlated, both 0 or both 1. And so I can't have them uncorrelated because then there'll be these other terms like 0, 1 hanging around. And in fact, you can show that if the XY distribution is anything other than 0, 0, plus 1, 1, you don't get a joint distribution because these two marginals already imply that the XY marginal is gonna have to be a half 0, 0, plus a half 1, 1. Okay, so that's the marginal problem. Let's think of it more generally now. So suppose I have three binary variables, X, Y, Z, like before, And I want to know what kinds of constraints do these six marginals here over the singletons and the pairs can satisfy in order for there to exist a joint distribution over three variables that yields them. So it turns out the answer is what I'll call marginal compatibility constraints, it's these constraints here where, you know, there's some obvious ones, like the marginal over X had better be consistent with the marginal over X and Y and the marginal over X and Z. If that fails, then obviously these guys are not going to be consistent with some distribution, something for Y and Z. But then there's some non-trivial ones which correspond to inequalities. These were equalities, like this one here. So this you can derive from this is a constraint on the six tuple of distributions. And how do I get that? Well, if you think about the statement that, you know, there exists, I'm going to call it Q now, joint distribution Q. And I do that just because last time when we did quantifier elimination, you know, the little Qs were the things we were eliminating. So this is going to remind you, because it's going to be quantifier elimination again. So if I just write out all the equations that define the marginals in terms of that joint distribution, so here the marginal on xy for values little x, little y is obtained from the full joint distribution. So in this case, there's sort of eight probabilities here. I sum over two possible values of z, and I get expressions for each of the four probabilities here. Similarly, I got four equations here, and then the singleton marginals, I get two equations for each of those. And then, of course, for Q to be a distribution, it has to satisfy positivity and be less than one. So those are the constraints, and then I just do quantifier elimination. I say, well, I want to know what constraints hold on just the P's when these equalities and these inequalities hold. But the nice thing now is that this is linear quantifier elimination because all the equalities are linear. So I've got a linear system equation for the Q's. I can solve for the Q's in terms of the P's, apply the inequalities. And what I can derive then is the trivial constraints here, but also this kind of inequality that I showed you. So that's where it comes from. And now, I mean, if I go to, you know, more than binary variables and a higher number of variables, at some point it becomes difficult to do the full linear quantifier elimination. But you can often ask questions like, well, maybe if I'm not interested in all the marginals, I'm only interested in some of them, maybe I can eliminate all the quantities except for those ones I'm interested in. So there are sort of variants of the marginal problem, but it all boils down to linear quantifier elimination. So if I go back to my second example here, you know, the first thing I'll notice is that the trivial constraints are satisfied, right? We didn't note that explicitly before, but the marginal on X is uniform, and that's consistent with both places where X appears. Similarly with Y and Z. And then if I just test that inequality constraint, and I'll look at the case where X, Y, and Z take the value 0, 0, 0, this is what the inequality constraint looks like in that case. So I just have to compute. So on the left-hand side, if I say, what's the probability that X is 0? That's a half. What's the probability Y is 0? That's a half. What's the probability Z is 0? That's a half. So I get those terms. And then if I ask, oh, what's the probability that any pair has the value 0, 0? The answer is always probability 0. So the left-hand side's 3 halves. That's greater than 1. So I get my violation. And that proves that this situation where I have anti-correlation between every pair is not compatible with some joint distribution over the three variables. OK. If I look at my third example, I get a similar situation. Now I use the case 0, 0, 1. I plug in all the probabilities for those distributions, and I again get something that's greater than 1, so that I can rule out that third example as a possible. I can learn that there's no joint distribution over the three variable that's compatible with those bivariate distributions. Okay, and now notice that I can have a variant of the marginal problem. This is going to come up towards the end of the talk, where I don't just ask for any old distribution that has these as its marginals. I might ask for, is there some distribution which has some other properties? Like, is there some distribution that's symmetric under exchange of Y and Z that has these guys? And so if you look at it, you say, well, PYZ has that symmetry. So yeah, maybe, you know, there's nothing that seems to conflict with that constraint. But actually, the answer is no, because although this pattern of correlations is consistent with some joint distribution, namely this one, this is actually the only distribution that gives these marginals. And it's not symmetric under YZ exchange, right? If I flip Y and Z, I'll get a 0, 1, 0 term and a 1, 0, 1 term, and those aren't there. So I know that this version of the marginal problem has no solution for these guys. And you know, more general versions of this problem won't be any more computationally difficult, because if I add constraints having to do with symmetries, for example, they're still just equalities in terms of all these variables Q that I'm trying to eliminate. And so I can still do linear quantifier elimination. It doesn't suddenly become a non-linear quantifier elimination problem, and so it still can be achieved efficiently. Okay, and I'm not gonna bother to derive any inequalities in this case. Okay, so far I've been talking about like what are, you know, inequality constraints that tell you exactly when some, you know, that can witness that some set of distributions over different subsets of variables is not consistent with some joint distribution. But there's an easier version, which I like to call the satisfiability version, which is the one on the bottom. So rather than saying find all the constraints for a set of distributions on some subsets of variables, such that they can be the marginals of some joint distribution, instead you might be saying, look, I've got some very particular set of distributions on the subsets of variables. Like, you know, in those examples I had very specific ones. And maybe rather than deriving just all the constraints, all the inequalities, and then testing those, I could just say, could I just test directly for this one particular distribution? And it turns out that's an easier computational problem, because all you're doing is saying, you know, if you've given me these guys, you know, numerically specified as certain specific distributions, then I just want to know, hey, is there some solution to this set of linear equations and inequalities? Some solution Q, and that's just a linear program asking if there's a Q that satisfies all these guys. And so it's relatively easy to do that numerically. And if you find that the answer is no, there is no solution, then it's also easy to ask your program to return a witness of infeasibility, which just means a single inequality, not a complete set of all the inequalities, but a single inequality that witnesses that your particular set of distributions on subsets does not admit of an explanation in terms of some underlying joint distribution. So, you know, often that's all you want to do. You don't necessarily want to know all the constraints. You might just want to know for some specific problem, is there a solution or not? And that with more variables that have higher cardinalities, that's really all you can hope for is a program that just sort of, you can query it and say, you know, is this set of distributions on subsets of variables a possible set of marginals of some joint distribution? Okay, so everything I've told you up till now, nothing to do with causal structure. Again, it's just about probability theory. The marginal problem is, you know, just a branch of probability theory. You know, what can we say about sets of distributions on subsets of variables? When can we say that they're consistent with some joint distribution? Nothing to do with causal structure, but I'm going to show that if you have if you leverage facts about the marginal problem, you can actually use them for causal inference. So that's where we're going. So how does the inflation technique work for assessing compatibility of distributions with causal structures? So I need to set up some definitions. So the first definition is going to be the notion of an inflation diag. Okay, so we're going to use as the example for most of this lecture of just the triangle scenario. I've changed my notation a bit so that I could reuse some old slides. So now triangles here mean observed variables. The yellow nodes mean the unobserved ones. And I'm not using Greek letters for the unobserved ones. I'm just going to use X, Y, Z here. Okay, so this is just the triangle scenario. Here's an example of another DAG, which is an inflation of this DAG, right? So for any DAG, not just the triangle, I can say draw an inflation. And the key thing is that it only has variables that correspond to variables in the original DAG, but I can have multiple copies of variables in the initial DAG. And I, you know, denote that by just sort of adding an index. So A gets indices 1, 2, there can be more versions of A. So we call these the copy indices. You know, which copy of A are you talking about? There may be multiple in your inflation DAG. And the key property of this inflation DAG is that for every observed variable, if I look at its ancestry, so the whole sub-DAG that includes all of its ancestors, it should look exactly like the ancestral subgraph of A back in the original DAG. Okay? So this would be an example. The inner A here has the same ancestry, but so does the outer A. It also has an X and a Y as its ancestors. So if I look at something like C on the outer ring here, it has the same ancestry as C does in the original DAG.
Why can't Y1 also be an ancestor of A2? Why do you have to have a new one?
If A2 had both Y1 and Y2 as ancestors?
No. Let's say Y2 doesn't exist. X1 and X2 are connected to A2 as well.
X1 and Y1, you mean?
Yeah.
That would be okay, yeah. So if you said, okay, it's not Y2, it's an error from here, then that would be an inflation DAG because A2 would have the right ancestry. So there's lots of different possibilities. I think I have a slide shortly showing a few different ones. Let's see. Let me fast forward a couple of slides and then come back. So yeah, here's an example of just a few different inflations. So this one, all I've done is, whereas originally I had a common cause of A and B, I just have two copies of Y, one which influences A1, the other one which influences B1. So it's very different. I can't support correlation to A1 and B1 here. But this is still an inflation DAG because each variable has the right set of ancestors. A has a Y as an ancestor, B has a Y as an ancestor. Your example where Y1 also points over to A2, that's another fine example of an inflation DAG, different from this one. And in fact, I think it's probably, no, it's not embedded in here, but this one, I think usually we call this the web inflation. So each A has sort of a different pair of X and Ys as its parents. A1 has X1, Y1, A2 has X1, Y2, and so on. So I'm not gonna say too much in this lecture about sort of which kinds of inflations are particularly useful for getting constraints. For now, I just wanna sort of make it clear what the definition is, because I wanna explain why it works. So have I answered your question? Yeah. Okay, so let me go back. So I'm gonna have this notion, this equivalence notion, which just means if you give me a set of variables from the DAG G, and then some set of variables from the DAG G prime, then I'll say that the two sets are sort of equivalent up to copy indices if X prime has exactly one copy of every node in X. So if this set was like, I don't know, ABC, and this one was A1, B1, C2, okay, then we have copy index equivalent sets of variables. And furthermore, if I'm looking at a sub-DAG of G prime and a sub-DAG of G, then as long as X prime and X are copy index equivalent, and there's an edge present between two nodes in X prime, whenever that same edge is present between two nodes in X, then I'm gonna say that these two sub-DAGs are copy index equivalent. And now I can give a sort of simple definition of what criterion G prime has to satisfy to be considered an inflation of G. And the answer is if you just look at all your nodes in G prime, then the ancestral subgraph of a given node AI has to be the same as the ancestral subgraph of the corresponding node A back in the original graph. Okay, so that's just what I said in pictures, but this is the definition. Okay, so all of these are examples where that's true for every node. Its ancestry is the same as in the original. And notice that the root nodes here, they all have no parents. So trivially, they have the same ancestry as the original nodes. Good. So why is this notion interesting? Well, okay, so there's one more thing I have to tell you, which is that now when I say, well, what's the model? Like, what's the set of parameters I want to allow to add to this new inflation graph? It's similar to what we had before with one extra constraint. So remember back in our usual Bayesian causal models, we allow for a variable to depend on its parents using any conditional probability whatsoever. So the kinds of distributions over ABC we can have are just what you can achieve by multiplying these conditionals together for any choice of these parameters. And it's going to be the same over here, except that whenever you have some two variables that are copy index equivalent, like here there's going to be a distribution over Y1 and a distribution over Y2, we demand that they're the same, okay? And so like here for this, what we call the cut inflation, there's just sort of one of these constraints. But in other cases where you've got, you know, so here every variable has two copies, now the semi-constraints is the way A1 depends on its parents should be the same as the way A2 depends on its parents, and so on, right? So that all the dependencies here are picking out the full scope of possibilities, but there's this correlation now. Each A depends on its parents in exactly the same way in the model. Okay, so just again to formalize that, if G prime is an inflation of G, and you have a model M prime on this inflation graph G prime, which you're getting from the model M, well, that's we're gonna call that an inflated model if and only if the way AI depends on its parents in this inflation graph is the same as the way any other A depends on its parents. So AJ for any AI in AJ. Okay, so what's the use of this? Well, defining inflation models in this way means that compatibility relative to your original graph is gonna imply compatibility relative to your inflated model. So what do I mean by that? So remember that, you know, a distribution on some observed variables is compatible with a DAG if you can assign some parameter choices that yield it. So you give me a distribution of ABC, it's compatible if I can find choices of these parameters that give me your distribution. And I can say the same for some marginal distribution, like you know, you give me a distribution on just A and C, okay, well A and C in this DAG depend, you know, I can take this, times these guys, that'll give me, you know, or just take this expression, marginalize over C, you'll get this. So the question is, does there exist parameters in this model that give me PAC? That's compatibility. And now if the set of variables you're looking at has a certain special property, then compatibility in the original DAG will imply compatibility in this inflated model. So that we're gonna call those sets injectable. So that we're gonna look at sets over on the inflated model, and we sort of say that they can be injected back into the original model. And so the idea is just that if I consider a set now, so like A2 and C1, it's injectable if its whole ancestry is the same as in the original. So all that was guaranteed by the definition of an inflation DAG is that each singleton set has the right ancestry. But there's no guarantee that pairs of variables should have the same ancestry, but some of them do. So here A2 and C1 in this spiral inflation have exactly the same ancestry as A and C. You know, those sub DAGs are exactly the same. Or here's a different example, B1 and B2. There's nothing in the original DAG that has the same ancestry because there's only a single copy of B back here. So this is not an injectable set, right? B1 and B2, the joint distribution over B1 and B2 in this model does not map onto anything back here. But another example, B2, C2, that could have been an injectable set, but because the Zs that B looks at and the Z that C looks at is not the same, the joint distributions over B2, C2 here are actually going to be factorizing, which is different from what I would have seen here. So B2 and C2 are also not injectable. Okay, so let's take the one case we did find. There are more, but take this example, A1, C1 for this cut inflation. That's an injectable set because, as we saw earlier, it has the same ancestry as back in the original. And so now we know that I can write out what the joint distribution over A1, C1 is over here in this model. It's just the product of the conditionals times the distributions over the latents that they see. And over in the original graph, I could also write out the joint distribution over AC. It looks like this. But remember, the definition of an inflation model is that this, the scope of possibilities for this are exactly the same as for this. Similarly here to here, these are all copy index equivalent. So the set of possibilities for this joint is exactly the same as for this. And therefore, if you've given me a distribution on the original model that's compatible with that model, well then, the corresponding distribution, so the distribution over A1, C1 that's just given by that particular distribution, is compatible over here. Okay, so that's true whenever the set you're looking at has this special property of being injectable. Okay, if it's not, like here's an example, A1, B1, that's not an injectable set, because if I look at the ancestry of A1 and B1, they, you know, I'm ignoring C2, so they basically factorize, right? So if I write down the expression for the joint A1, B1 over here in this model, I find that it indeed factorizes, because there's a Y1 dependence for B1 and a Y2 dependence for A1. There's Y1, there's Y2. So there's no correlations between those guys. Whereas back in the original model, there was just a single y, and so I did have correlations. So if you give me a distribution over AB that's compatible over here, it does not imply that the corresponding distribution on A1 and B1 is compatible over here. So only some compatibility rate relations back here carry over to the inflation. Okay, so if we look at this simple example and say, well, what are all the sets that are injectable in the sense? Well, the singletons, that's guaranteed from the definition of an inflation diag. All the singletons are going to match what we had over there. And then here, there's a couple of sets with two elements. So A1C1 is injectable, and B1C1 is injectable, but not A1B1. And certainly not the triple either, because it includes A1 and B1. So this is it. These are the injectable sets for this inflation diag. And that means that if you give me some 5-tuple of distributions over A, B, C, A, C, and B, C, and they're compatible with this model, meaning, you know, there is some distribution P, A, B, C that's compatible with this model that has each of these guys as marginal distributions, then it's also true that this corresponding 5-tuple, which is given by exactly the distributions you gave me, that's compatible with M prime, by which I mean that there's some distribution over A1, B1, C1 compatible with this DAG that gives these guys as marginals. And the reason, of course, is just that, what choice of parameter should I make? Well, just choose whatever the parameters that yielded these guys over here. That was guaranteed. When you told me this was compatible, it meant that there existed some choice of parameters that would give a joint distribution with these marginals. So I just take those parameters over here. And because I'm only looking at sets that are injectable, that parallel exactly what I see over here, those parameters are going to give me exactly what I need. Okay? So there's some definitions, but it's not a complicated idea. So if I look at the spiral inflation instead of the cut inflation, then I can go looking for all the injectable sets, and I have more of them now, so like A1 and B1. So A1, B1, it has the same ancestry as A and B. Actually, A1, B1, C1, the triple that's on the inside here, that's just a triangle itself, whereas A2, B2, C2 is not. So the A2, B2, C2 is not in this set. Certain pairs are in it, like C1, A1, C1, A1, but not things like C2, A1. That's not an injectable set. Okay, so you can go looking for these opportunities of, compatibility in one, implying compatibility in the other. And so now I want to show you how this helps you witness causal incompatibility of some distribution with the original DAG. So we'll use that example that we've seen previously, the simplest one, where, a perfect correlation between the three variables, A, B, and C, is incompatible with this guy. We saw why in another lecture, sort of it's intuitive. And now we're going to see how can we witness that using this logic of inflation. So I'm going to, the way the proof is going to go is we're going to assume that it is compatible, we're going to derive a contradiction. Okay, so if this distribution is compatible with this model here, then it means that the marginals on AC and BC, which are just this and this, so they're also perfectly correlated between A and C and B and C, well, then they're going to be compatible with M, because remember, the definition of compatibility of some set is just, does there exist a joint that has these as marginals that's compatible? So if I tell you that there does, then obviously these guys are compatible. Okay, so we start there, that we have these joint distributions AC, BC that are compatible. But if we look AC and BC for the cut inflation, so let's say I use this cut inflation here, AC and BC are, we saw they were both injectable sets, right? A1, C1. And B1, C1, map back to AC and BC over there. So if these pairwise distributions are compatible, then the corresponding pairwise distributions on the one in the inflated diag, right, so where PA1, C1 is taken to be the distribution PAC, and PB1, C1 is taken to be that distribution over PBC, so just like this, then those guys are compatible with this model as well. Okay. So I've just leveraged the fact that some compatibilities carry over as long as we're talking about injectable sets. So at the end of the day, like all I've done now is I said, we started with a question about, is this thing compatible with the original model? And I've translated it over to a question of, oh, is this set of things compatible with this different model that has a different structure? But now actually the second question is easier to answer. So we're going to use that. So we've gotten to this question here. And now I'm going to show you that actually it's very easy to see that this is not compatible with this model. And that's going to tell us that the original guy was not compatible either. So what's the proof of this? Well, we saw in the first half when we were talking about the marginal problem that if you have perfect correlation between A1 and C1 and perfect correlation between B1 and C1, then you have to have perfect correlation between A1 and B1. No other distribution will yield a compatible, a marginally compatible triple. Because, you know, one way to see it is just, look, if A is perfectly correlated with C and C is perfectly correlated with B, then A and B are going to have to be perfectly correlated as well. So yeah, we saw that earlier on. And that violates the fact that here in this DAG, A1 and B1 are deseparated given the empty set, which means that they should be conditionally independent, or sorry, marginally independent. But if A1 and B1 are perfectly correlated, they're not marginally independent. So that's why this pair of distributions definitely cannot arise in this causal structure.
But you, if you prove that these are not compatible, why? Because in the original tag, the A and B could be correlated.
Right.
So if you show that it's not compatible with M prime, it's not necessarily incompatible with M.
The logic though was that we said, like, if this pair of bivariate distributions are compatible with M, then the corresponding pair should be compatible with M prime. And so if I show incompatibility here of this guy, that's going to imply incompatibility of these guys over here. Yeah. So you're right that just looking at this and noticing that A and B could be correlated kind of doesn't give you that. But by sort of leveraging the places where they agree and the fact that over here we have some extra constraints, I can learn that the distribution I was talking about is not compatible with what's going on here.
Maybe even gone further than and separated Z1 and X1 and X2 and everything.
Well, if you'd done that, then the problem is that the number of injectable sets would have gone down. If the only thing that the two models share in common would be, say, like the joint distribution over AC, so I say, okay, well, this perfect correlation has to be mimicked over here, that wouldn't be strong enough to get me a contradiction on this side. Okay, so it's important that I use both those guys because these two distributions sort of implied that the distribution over A1, B1 would have to be also perfectly correlated, which is inconsistent with this guy. So that's, that's how it works. So yeah, let me just finish the argument. So now if I remember that compatibility on injectable sets on the left implies compatibility on the right, then, the contrapositive holds, that incompatibility here gives me incompatibility back in the original. And remember, in the original, we had this implication between compatibility of the joint to compatibility of these particular marginals. So if I've shown incompatibility of these particular marginals, I've shown incompatibility of the joint, again, just by the contrapositive. So at the end of the day, I've proven what I wanted to prove, that, you know, using this technique, I can show that that joint distribution involving perfect correlation is not compatible with the original DAG. So here's the general pattern. So if you tell me that M prime is a inflation model of M, so you know the M was a model on some DAG G, G prime was an inflation of G, and M prime was an inflated model, so it had the right symmetry properties. You know, every variable depended on its parents in exactly, every two copy index variables depended on their parents in the same way. Then if you give me a set of injectable sets over here on G prime, so that's like in our example we were just looking at, we had AC, BC, they were the injectable sets, so this would just be those guys. And then I can find the corresponding sets back in the original DAG, like AC and BC. So we call those the images of the injectable sets back in the original DAG. Well, then what we saw was that compatibility of the probability distributions on every one of those sets here. So I'm just going to write, you know, the set like AC and BC is just some bold V here. So think of this as a joint distribution or a, so this is like really a tuple of probability distributions, one for every element of this set up here. We saw that compatibility of those guys will imply compatibility of the corresponding tuple of distributions for this set V prime when you set each of the elements of this tuple equal to its corresponding element over there. So we infer from this compatibility the compatibility with M prime of this new tuple of distributions. So this is just the general pattern. And that means that if you prove incompatibility of these guys over here in the inflated, then you learn that the original ones were incompatible. Okay, so let me pause there for questions before moving on to use this to derive some inequalities. So far, so good? Okay, so how can we use this to derive some new inequalities? So first, a definition of a causal compatibility inequality. So suppose I give you an inequality on the set of distributions over some injectable sets. So this is the set of injectable sets on some graph. This is the tuple of distributions for every element of this set. And suppose that I is just some inequality that takes, you know, the elements of that tuple and evaluates to some, or and specifies that that particular function has to be less or some constant. Okay, so IS is going to be an inequality that refers to that tuple of distributions. And now, if you give me a tuple of distributions that's compatible with the model, that whenever you give me that, I find that this inequality is satisfied. So if that's a property that the inequality has, that it's satisfied by all the compatible guys, then we're going to call that a causal compatibility inequality. Okay, so it's a necessary condition. So violation of this inequality will tell me that some distribution is incompatible. Satisfaction doesn't necessarily imply that's compatible. So it could be an outer approximation to this set of valid tuples of distributions. But whenever it actually witnesses incompatibility, can witness incompatibility, we can call it a causal compatibility inequality for this model. So far I've just sort of defined the kind of thing we're looking for. We're looking for inequalities back in the original DAG that will be able to test for incompatibility. That sometimes I'll give it some tuple of distributions on various subsets of variables and the inequality will be violated and I can say, right, that's inconsistent with this model. We're doing inflation, and we know that for any set of injectable sets of variables and their corresponding things back in the original DAG, well, we know compatibility here implies compatibility over here. Therefore, if you give me some causal compatibility inequality over in the inflated model, so I'll call that IS prime. So let's suppose you give me such an inequality. It's going to be satisfied by these distributions, right? Because these distributions are compatible with that model. So I can infer that this guy's going to be satisfied. But when I evaluate this tuple of distributions on this inequality, I could just as well have taken the original distributions, right? They're exactly functionally the same. So I can say, well, that's the same as just considering the corresponding set back here that just doesn't have the subscripts, right? It's the original variables A, B, C rather than A1 or A2. So that corresponding inequality on those variables is going to be satisfied by the corresponding tuple of distributions that are exactly the same. So this is not saying anything profound. It's just, I can think of that inequality in two ways. So basically, I've shown that if you give me some tuple of distributions over these images of injectable sets, any causal compatibility inequality over in the inflated model will imply that there's a causal compatibility back in the original model, right? Because this sequence of inferences just means that, compatibility of a tuple of distributions on M means that some inequality IS is satisfied. And so just by dropping all the copy indices, the subscripts, from this IS prime, I get a causal compatibility inequality back from my original model, which is what I was looking for.
Can they map to the same thing, inequalities? So inequalities in model M prime, if you have
yep.
two of them. Yeah. But if you say there is an inequality that is satisfied.
Yep. If the two on M prime only differed in sort of the subscripts they use. So like this one has an A1 and this one has an A2, then they'll map back to exactly the same inequality. Yeah. Okay, so summarizing that, if I find some causal compatibility inequalities over here on model M prime for just tuples of distributions on these special subsets of variables, then I can immediately pull them back and say that's also an inequality that's going to hold true in the original model. So that's the scheme for deriving, oops, don't know what happened there. We'll just wait a second. Yeah, that's the scheme for how we can derive inequalities in the original model. And what I'm going to show you next is how it's sort of easier to derive causal compatibility inequalities in the inflated model, because you'll notice the inflated model has a bunch of independences in it. It's got more structure. You know, remember those equality constraints that came from deseparation? You tend to get those in graphs that aren't too connected. Right? If everything's all connected, you're going to have no deseparation relations. You're not going to have much in the way of independences. But this inflation technique basically gives us some nice independence relations to use to get causal compatibility constraints, which we can then pull back to the original model. So this is the pattern. So let me show you how it works with some concrete examples. So in a moment, I'll persuade you that as long as A, B, and C are binary variables, then this inequality here, which refers to A1, B1, C1, so of course A1, B1, and C1 are going to have to be binary as well because they're, you know, they're meant to be isomorphic to the original variables. So this inequality here for the distributions over B1, C1, A1, C1, and the marginals on A1 and B1 and C1 is going to be a valid causal compatibility inequality over here for this cut inflation of the triangle. And so then the result we just derived, that I can sort of pull back any valid causal compatibility inequalities over the inflated model to the original, means that the corresponding inequality, where all I've done now is drop the subscript here, that's a causal compatibility inequality back in this original model. So that's something that can test for, you know, you give me a joint distribution over ABC and I can now test whether it's valid or not. So all I need to do is persuade you that this is indeed a valid causal compatibility inequality over here in this model. Okay, so the first step is noticing that there's a slightly different inequality, this one here, where the difference is that now I have a joint distribution over A1, B1, right? The one I showed you on this slide had a factorizing distribution over A1, B1. But this one I've given you here, that is just an inequality that follows for any set of marginals on A1, C1, B1, C1, and A1, B1. It's just marginal compatibility, nothing to do with causal structure at all. We saw that in the early part of the lecture that, you know, if I do quantifier elimination and say, is there a joint distribution Q over A1, B1, C1 that has these marginals, I'll find that the marginals have to satisfy this constraint for it to be consistent. So there's nothing about causation here. This is just a lot like what we talked about with, you know, Shannon type inequalities. That's just constraints on the relationship between parts and wholes in probability theory. Nothing to do with causation. Okay, so if you tell me that I've got a valid set of marginals, this inequality holds. But now if you tell me more and you say, well, that triple of bipartite distributions should also be compatible with this DAG here, the cut inflation of the triangle. Well, now I can say more. I can say, well, because here I have a deseparation between A1 and B1, that means that they have to be conditionally independent in the joint distribution, which means that the marginal on A1 and B1 has to factorize. So if you give me this triple and you say it's both compatible with M prime, and you know, being compatible with M prime means that there has to be some joint distribution over A1, B1, C1 that yields them. You know, so both of these constraints are going to hold. Because if there's a joint distribution that's compatible with this diagonal, well, then there's definitely some joint distribution that has them as marginals. So that joint distribution is going to have marginals that satisfy this. So I can combine both these constraints. So if you tell me that this three tuple here is compatible with M prime, then it means that I can just plug this equality into here, because both of these equations ought to be valid, and get a new inequality. And that's going to hold true for any three tuple that's compatible with this model. So all I've done is combine something from probability theory, which is just a marginal constraint, with this one very simple fact about the causal structure of inflation, namely this deseparation here, to get a non-trivial inequality over at the level of the inflation. And so what I've proven here is just that this is a causal compatibility inequality in the inflated model, right? You can, if you want to know if there's some distribution over variables A1, B1, C1 in the inflated model, you just can test this inequality. If it's violated, you know that distribution is not compatible. But now our earlier result said, right, and because all the subsets we're looking at here, A1, C1, B1, C1, and the singletons, A1, B1, C1, all those subsets are injectable. That means that, you know, if the marginals on those subsets are incompatible over here, then they're going to be incompatible over here, or vice versa. If the corresponding marginals are compatible, then that implies compatibility over here. And so I can pull this inequality, which witnesses incompatibility, back to the corresponding inequality where I've now dropped those copy indices. Okay, so that's the pattern. Questions about that?
Sorry, you said in the second graph, P1, C1 becomes PB1 times PC1 because they're de-separated?
No, sorry. PA1, B1 became the product
of the
PA1, PB1.
Yeah.
No, just that one, right? So if I look at this inequality, the only term that I've substituted is this piece. It has become a product. The others have not. But that's the point is that, like, I've now made it so that the only things that appear in this inequality are distributions over sets of variables that are of this injectable variety, that the distributions will look exactly like they did back in the original graph. The scope of possibilities are the same as in the original graph. Okay, so now let's just revisit our you know, incompatibility of this correlated distribution with this DAG. Let's just double check that this inequality we've now derived can really see that. So we say, all right, let's take that inequality, and it's actually, you know, 8 inequalities for all the possible values of these 3 variables, A, B, C. So take A, B, C to be 0, 0, 1. I get this version of the inequality. And now I can just substitute these probabilities from this distribution, and I'll find that the marginal probabilities for A being 0, B being 0, and C being 0 are all 1/2. That means that this term here is just 1/2 times 1/2, which is 1/4, so I'm subtracting off 1/4. But the BC and the AC marginals have no anticorrelation in them, so those terms are 0. So this whole thing gives me 3/2 minus 1/4, that's 5/4. That's greater than 1, so the inequality is violated, so it witnesses the incompatibility of that distribution. But I can do a lot more than that. I can do things like, oh, if I start adding noise to that distribution, at what point does this inequality, you know, become satisfied? At the point where it becomes satisfied doesn't mean that the distribution is necessarily compatible, because this is just a necessary condition for incompatibility. Violating this tells you definitely it's incompatible. Satisfying it, it might be compatible, it might be not. But if you get enough such inequalities, then you can start to sort of get a tight approximation to the actual set of compatible distributions. Okay, now I just want to make a side point that although I've been working in terms of inequalities on, you know, the joint distributions themselves and the distributions of marginals, I could also take other kinds of information. So if instead of focusing on joint distributions, you look at correlators. So in a sort of physicist notation, if my binary variables A, B, and C are now assigned values plus or minus 1 rather than 0 and 1, then I can talk about the correlation between, say, A1 and C1 in terms of the expectation value of their product. So if they're both plus or they're both minus, then this expectation value is going to be plus. They're positively correlated. If one's plus and one's minus, then the expectation value is negative. They're negatively correlated. If the expectation value is 0, it means there's equal likelihood for those two patterns. So they're equally likely to be correlated as anticorrelated. So this is a nice way of talking about the kinds of correlations. And in the case of binary variables, you know, these correlators can just be expressed in terms of the joint distributions and over A1, C1, and the marginals on A1 and C1. And the point is that if you give me a causal compatibility inequality that is expressed not in terms of probabilities, but in terms of just correlators, then the logic still holds. I can pull that back and get a corresponding inequality in the original DAG as long as these things are all defined in terms of distributions on the injectable sets, right? So this correlator can be inferred if you give me the joint distribution of A1, C1. that's something that's common between here and here. So that means that I can say it's going to be that this kind of constraint involving only injectable sets will be pulled back to the original. So, you know, maybe a bit more explicitly, the proof would go something like this. If you tell me that you have a triple of marginals on pairs of variables that are just a valid set of marginals, then not only do they satisfy that inequality I gave you in terms of the p's, but here's an inequality on the correlators it satisfies. So this is a form of solution of the marginal problem, but it relates specifically to correlators. Okay, so you can show that by quantifier elimination. And then you can do the same thing. You can say, well, when I notice that A1 has to be independent of B1, for the correlators, that means that this correlator has to factorize into the expectation value for A1 times the expectation value of B1. And so I can plug that back up into that equation. And when I do that, I get this. So I just have to factorize this term, move it over to the right-hand side, and I get this equation. And so that's a causal compatibility inequality for M prime. So it's the kind of thing, you know, it's just some function of the distributions. So it's the kind of thing that I can pull back into a valid inequality over here as well. Okay, so there's nothing specific to inequalities involving probability distributions. You can really do lots of different things. So if you want to do it in terms of entropies, you can do it in terms of entropies as well. Sorry, I jumped the gun. I was just going to say that you can see the incompatibility of this perfect correlation equally well with this inequality. So now, remember, these things have taken the values plus and minus. So the idea is that the correlator between A and C here, it's always positive correlation. Here, it's always positive correlation as well. So the left-hand side's 2. The expectation value of A is 0 because it's equally likely to be plus or minus, similarly with B. So the right-hand side is 1. So I've got a violation of the inequality. So the other thing I wanted to point out was that I can do this for entropic inequalities. So it turns out this is a valid entropic inequality for this DAG. And so because it only refers to joint distributions on A1, C1, C1, B1, and the marginal on C1, I can pull it back and get a valid inequality in the original.
Is there a systematic way of finding all of these inequalities? Because
I'm coming to that. Right now I'm just sort of showing you, the kind of breadth of the technique. Like, what are the limits of the technique? What can you do with it? But I'll come in shortly to say something more about sort of everything you can get at a given, for a given inflation. The logic is the same, that it turns out that this inequality, where now I have a term involving the mutual information between A1 and B1, this is again one of those just constraints on joint distributions, on marginals that follow from the existence of a joint distribution. So this is in fact one of those Shannon type inequalities that we talked about last time. But unlike last time, this is a Shannon type inequality that does not refer to latent variables of the DAG you're interested in. Instead, it refers to observed variables of this alternative DAG that you've defined in terms of the DAG you're interested in, that has a lot of the same structure as the DAG you're interested in. So that's the difference. But now we do the same thing. We say, all right, well, that is going to be true of all sets of marginals. But because A1 and B1 are independent in the causal structure I'm interested in, the mutual information between A1 and B1 has to be 0. So that term disappears. And so I'm left with this inequality. And therefore, if my triple of bipartite distributions are going to be compatible with M prime, they better satisfy this inequality. So that's how I get this as a causal compatibility inequality, which I can then pull back. And again, it's the same thing. I can witness the incompatibility of this guy using that inequality just by noticing that A and C have mutual information 1 because there are sort of 2 bits that are perfectly correlated. Similarly, C and B have mutual information 1. The entropy of C is 1, and so 2 is not less than or equal to 1, so I've seen the incompatibility. Okay, let's go to something harder. So this distribution is not perfect correlation between the 3 bits. It's more like, if any of you have seen the W state in quantum information theory, which is a coherent superposition of 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and 1, 0, 0. This is like an incoherent version of the W state. Okay, it turns out that's also incompatible with the triangle, but it's actually much harder to detect it. So if you use the kinds of techniques we talked about last time, where you're doing quantifier elimination on entropies and you get, you know, all your Shannon type inequalities, none of them will witness the incompatibility of this guy with that causal structure. If you use, there's some techniques that involve quantifier elimination with correlators, it also doesn't see the incompatibility. But the inflation technique can. And so you have to go beyond that cut inflation we've talked about to this more general kind of inflation, the spiral inflation. And what you can show is that this inequality here ends up being a causal compatibility inequality for this DAG. So if I look at this, there's an A1, B1, C1 term in it. Well, A1, B1, C1 is an injectable set because it has the triangle structure. There's a A2, C1 term in it. If I look at A2 and C1, yeah, they have the right structure to be injectable. There's a B1, C2. B1, C2, they're connected by a single Z. They're also injectable. Similarly with A1, B2, and then there's all the singletons. So everything on this side is corresponds to an injectable set, so I can pull that inequality back. I get a valid causal compatibility inequality over in the original DAG. And it turns out, I won't do the math, but if you plug in the probabilities for this guy into here, you'll find that this distribution violates that inequality. So this inequality can detect the incompatibility of this distribution with the triangle scenario. So, okay, very briefly, how does this work? Well, I start with a different inequality on A1, B1, C1, A2, B2, C2, which just follows from probability theory. So this is just part of the solution to the marginal problem for these distributions over six variables. These particular trivariate distributions have to satisfy this inequality. And then I use facts about the causal structure. So here it's a bit more involved. So what are some interesting deseparation relations? A1, B2 is marginally independent of C2, meaning they're deseparated by the empty set. So A1 and B2, right, they have no common ancestor with C2 because C2 has Z as an ancestor, but B2 only has Z2 as an ancestor. I should have said Z1. So they have different Zs in their ancestry. You know, A has X1 as an ancestor, but C2 has X2 as an ancestor. So if I just dimmed out everything else, besides the ancestral sets of C2 and the ancestral set of A1 and B2, I would see that they topologically separate. And so they're deseparated, so there should be an independence relation, which I can write this way. And so that means that this term up here, A1, B2, C2, this guy here, is going to factorize in this way. And similarly, I get corresponding deseparations sort of by the symmetry. And then I have another one, which is that the guys on the outside, A2, B2, and C2, they also, like if I marginalize over A1, C1, and B1, there's no common ancestry between C2 and B2. And there's no common ancestry between A2 and B2, and no common ancestry between A2 and C2. So they're all marginally independent. So the one term up here that involves A2, B2, and C2, that's going to factorize in this three-way manner.
So why is C2 deseparated from A1? Because mm-hmm. we have a, sort of a fourth thing, but it's three edges from C2, Z1.
Okay, C2 and which is A1, B2, like the first guy here we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yep.
Well, there's a, like a similar to a fork that you have a Z1 there, and then so
yep.
Because you're not conditioning a Z1, C2 can be correlated with B1. Also, there's a fork.
The key is that you're not conditioning on B1. So let's say, what are the paths between C2 and either A1 or B2? The answer is there's this path here,
mm-hmm.
and there's this path here that goes me to E1, and then there's this path to B2. And the point is that because I'm not conditioning on C1 or B1, those paths are blocked. So I don't need to be conditioning on things like Z1 or X1 or Y1. That would work too, because they're forks. But because I'm not conditioning on the colliders, they're blocked. So yeah, other questions about this? So if I take all these factorization conditions and I plug them into that constraint, I get what I showed you on the previous slide. So this is now a causal compatibility inequality over here in the inflated DAG. And if you work out the injectable sets, right, I think I did this a couple of moments ago, it includes all the subsets that appear in that inequality. And that's why I can pull it back to a valid inequality over in the original DAG. And that can witness that this W distribution is incompatible with that DAG. Okay. So now I want to introduce towards saying something a bit more general about, you know, how do you turn this into an algorithm? Let me introduce a notion beyond the idea of an injectable set, which I'll call an expressible set. And so if I look at A1, B1 over here, that was an example of something, this is the cut inflation, that was not injectable because it didn't have the same ancestry as A and B. But I'm going to say it is expressible because when I write out the expression for the joint on A1, B1, it factorizes into these two pieces. And each of those pieces corresponds to something that I would see in the original graph, right? So if I just look at the marginal over B, it's B given Y and Z, its parents times the distribution over Y times the distribution over Z. Well, that's exactly the same expression as I have here in this factor, and similarly for the first factor. So the point is that the distribution over A1, B1 in this graph, if I ask, you know, the product distribution over a PA and a PB that are obtained from some joint that are compatible over here, is it compatible? Yes. Okay, so although the distribution over A1, B1 is not the same as the distribution over AB back in the original, I can find an expression for it in terms, as a sort of equation, in terms of the marginals of the original, right? So here it's just the product of the marginals on A and B separately. So that's what I mean by it's expressible. Like, even though it's not equal, I can rewrite it in terms of things that are observed over here in the original DAG. So if you look at, you know, there's some sets that are neither injectable nor expressible. So if I look at A1, B1, and C1, that's not injectable because it doesn't have the right ancestry. But also, if I just write down the expression for it, it really does not correspond to any polynomial equation in terms of things that I could observe over here. So it's not an expressible set. Okay, so in this example, there's sort of only one non-trivial new expressible set beyond the injectable ones. Every injectable set is sort of trivially an expressible set because the function is just a trivial function. But here I get this one extra set, A1, B1. And so the set of all expressible sets here would be, you know, the injectable guys and this expressible guy here. Okay, and so, you know, in this cut inflation example, you know, that the images of the injectable sets are these. But the expressible sets are slightly larger. You know, over on this side where I have my variables with copy indices, I get this extra subset of the variables. And the point is that when you tell me that something on these images of injectable sets, some tuple of distributions are compatible, then I can find that there is set of distributions on all the expressible sets that I can conclude are compatible with M prime. So over on this extra guy, right, so all these ones, they just track what was over here. But on this guy, I say, oh, he has to be the product of PA and PB from over there. So if you've given me a 5-tuple that's compatible over here, then this 6-tuple on the expressible sets, where I've got this factorizing problem, is going to be compatible over here. Okay, so we've basically been using implicitly that idea. And the point is that everything I've shown you so far for how to describe causal compatibility inequalities basically required those inequalities that I started with at the top of the slide to refer only to expressible sets, because that's how I was able to rewrite those inequality in terms of injectable sets, right? So if I look at, you know, what I started with in this first example, A1, B1 was not any old subset of variables, it was an expressible set. And that means that I could rewrite it in terms of things that ultimately I could relate back to the original. So I could rewrite it in terms of injectable sets. So when I plug this in, I got an inequality that only involved injectable sets. That's why I was able to pull it back. So I needed to start with something that only involved expressible sets. So like in this other more complicated example we dealt with, you know, why this particular inequality to start with? Because each of these triple sets is expressible. It can be rewritten in terms of injectable sets. And so when I make that substitution, I'll get something that I can then pull back to the original. So what it means is that if you want to make an algorithm out of this, you really need to be able to go and find all the expressible sets in your inflation bag. And then say, what are the marginal compatibility constraints that hold on for the distributions on those expressible sets? Okay, so that's the question. How do we get that starting point, which I basically just pulled out of a hat up till now? And the answer is you do it with linear quantifier elimination, right? So you're gonna say find a set of distributions on, or you're gonna look at the distributions on just the expressible sets, and then you're gonna be asking, is there a joint distribution that's compatible with them? That's just gonna be the standard old linear quantifier elimination that we saw at the beginning of the talk. If the expressible sets do not include, you know, all the subsets, like in this example, all the subsets are in there, it just means I'm eliminating a few more parameters. Like, you know, say this is not among the expressible sets. Okay, I got to eliminate that too. Hasn't changed the nature of the problem. It's still linear quantifier elimination. It can still be done efficiently. So that's how I'll get inequalities that involve only the expressible sets, just by doing more linear quantifier elimination. So here's the pattern. You're going to get linear inequality constraints just from probability theory, from marginal compatibility. For things, you know, you're going to focus on marginal compatibility just on these expressible sets. It's not going to be too hard because it's linear quantifier elimination. This is the hardest part of the problem. Like in all of this causal inference, it's the quantifier elimination that's hard, but we got an easy version of it here. It's linear. And then we're going to combine it with polynomial equalities that follow from the structure of the inflated DAG. So I look at the deseparation relations in that DAG. I get some equalities. I can rewrite the distribution on this expressible set as a product of distributions on the injectable sets of which it's made. That's where the complication comes in, because now things become polynomials. I don't just have a single distribution appearing linearly. When I make this substitution into here, I get polynomial inequalities. Okay, but I haven't had to do any nonlinear quantifier elimination to get those polynomial inequalities. So I've basically sort of split the problem into sort of doing easy quantifier elimination and then combining that with polynomial equalities that are also easy to find, because I just use the deseparation theorem to find those guys. The hard part becomes that, you know, sometimes you have to go to higher levels of inflation where you have many copies of every variable, and then things become numerically difficult because you have sort of a very big quantifier elimination problem.
Yeah. Why don't we only make use of the equality constraints of the inflated bag? What if the inflated bag also has some inequality constraints?
You could make use of those as well, yeah. So the problem is that we kind of, yeah, maybe, you know, down the road when you have sort of more in the way of knowing stuff about inequality constraints, you can kind of pull them back. But if you don't have a lot of inequality constraints to begin with, this is a way of deriving them. But yeah, once you've got inequality constraints, you could put it through the meat grinder as well. Like, you think of inflation as just, you know, give me any causal compatibility inequality that you know to hold true over here in the inflated DAG on the injectable sets, and that will give you valid constraints back in the original DAG. So whatever those constraints look like, so I haven't, you know, mentioned nested Markov constraints, but that's another thing you could pull back as long as you're referring just to injectable sets at the end of the day. But the kind of plain vanilla version of it is, you know, just go looking at the deseparation relations. Those will give you equality constraints, and now you combine them with your linear inequalities to get polynomial inequalities. Okay, so this is what the kind of rough structure of an algorithm would look like. So first, you have to choose an inflation of your DAG, and I haven't said much about that, but there's certain inflation, there's kind of a hierarchy of inflations, like that web-like inflation I showed you before. You can define a kind of family of those where you're multiplying your hidden variables. Like in that web inflation I showed you, every unobserved variable was sort of had two copies. But I can go to cases where there's three copies and four copies, and then I have more and more observed variables, because for every sort of pairing of hidden variables, I get a new observed variables that looks at both of them. So that kind of hierarchy you can show actually sort of converges to the true set of compatible distributions. This is something that Ellie Wolf and Miguel Navasco has showed. But in any case, if you're not interested in sort of maybe getting a convergence of the full set, and you're just interested in sort of deriving some inequalities, You can think of this as starting by choosing a particular inflation that for whatever reason you think is going to be useful. And then you need an algorithm to go and find all the expressible sets, which is not hard to do because it's about just, you know, which ancestral sub DAGs here correspond to things in the original DAG. So you find the expressible sets. And now you derive linear inequalities for marginal compatibility of the distributions over just the expressible sets by eliminating all the other parameters, right? So you have this joint distribution with all its parameters. You get rid of all parameters besides these marginals on the expressible sets. And that, of course, is just linear quantifier elimination. So you do that. And then for each expressible set, you rewrite the distribution as a function of the distributions on the injectable sets, right? And that's just kind of using deseparation. You know, the reason something was an expressible set is that there was some deseparation relation that allowed me to express it in terms of injectable sets. So now I make that substitution. Those are my polynomial equalities. And I take those polynomial equalities, plug them into these inequalities I derived at this step, drop the copy indices, and now I get causal compatibility inequalities for the original guy. So if you do that for this spiral inflation of the triangle, these are all the inequalities you get. Here I've expressed them in terms of correlators because they're a little bit easier to see. And these are actually sets of inequalities because I can change the sign of, you know, A or B or C and get other inequalities that are also valid. So there's like 12 of this type, 8 of this type, 24, 8. So these are pretty powerful already at sort of picking out what kinds of distributions are compatible, what are not. But this is still just an outer and approximation to the actual set of compatible distributions, because you can show that if you go to a higher inflation, you can get more stringent constraints. And it's only in the limit that you're going to converge on the actual set. Now, so sometimes for some DAGs, you get lucky and there sort of comes a finite level of the hierarchy where you've got everything. But in general, that need not happen.
How do you know you've got everything?
Well, this is the, I mentioned earlier, there's a result by Ellie Wolf and Miguel Navasquez where they basically just have shown that this technique does converge in the limit to the semi-algebraic set that you're trying to characterize, you know, all and only the distributions that are compatible. But if you're asking, like, when do you know that at a finite level you can stop? That's a good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer. That, like in the case of the Bell scenario, it's true that you can stop at a finite level. And I'm just wondering how, like in that case, kind of we know that you can stop because we had already derived, say, all the CHSH inequalities previously. We knew what they looked like. We can derive them by quantifier elimination. It's just linear quantifier elimination. So you know, when at a certain level of inflation you see, oh, I've got all those, then you know you're done. But if you didn't know that already, then how would you know you're done? Perhaps if the next level up doesn't give you anything new, probably you can prove that it means that nothing else is going to give you anything new. And so as soon as you see that I'm getting no new inequalities, that's probably enough to tell you that you're done. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'll have to ask Ellie if...
Also another stupid question. So are all these inequalities derived by hand or?
No. Yeah, so this is all done in you know, mathematical software where you, you know, because the linear quantifier elimination is, you know, not hard compared to nonlinear quantifier elimination, but it's still you're still eliminating a lot of variables, and so you want to automate it. Yeah, I think it would be next to impossible to do this by hand. So only the simplest examples would you try to do this by hand. But yeah, it's all code that finds the expressible sets, does the linear quantifier elimination, substitutes the polynomial qualities, and spits this out. Okay, so let's wrap up. So everything I've done up till now has been kind of just cases where variables were deseparated by the empty set, right? I didn't have any conditional independences anywhere. So I thought it might be fun just to show an example where you use a conditional independence. So when we did this work years ago, there was this nice paper by Henson, Lal, Pusey that came out a few years earlier, and they were trying to find DAGs that they called them interesting, meaning that they admitted sort of non-trivial inequality constraints on the compatible distributions, and some of them that they were looking at they could prove. So most of them they looked at, they found that Shannon type entropic inequalities could prove that the thing was interesting, but for this one, for example, they couldn't show it, and so it's a good one to look at. Subsequently, Jacques Pinard showed that this was interesting because there's a distribution. So in this case, C here is observed. Don't worry about the coloring is inverted relative to what I had before. So sorry, these guys are the hidden ones now. These guys are the observed ones. So he showed that there is a joint distribution over the observed variables that's incompatible with this guy. But this still has all the right conditional independence relations. That means that there has to be some inequalities that rule out this distribution, right? So Pinard showed that, okay, yeah, there's gonna be some non-trivial inequalities here. So that means that we should be able to use inflation to derive some non-trivial inequalities. And so the question is, can you derive some inequalities that, for instance, rule out this distribution so that you could know something like, oh, how much noise would I be able to add to this and still have something that's incompatible? So here's the inflation you use. So you're doubling up some of the observed variables. You have two copies of A, two copies of B, two copies of C, two copies of Y, which is also observed, single copy of the unobserved Z, two copies of the unobserved X. And this is the set of expressible sets you use. So they're an A, a C, and two Ys. And over here I have B, a C, and two Ys. And so this is, again, just a kind of marginal constraint. So for any joint distribution over the observed variables in this inflated DAG, this is going to hold true. And now I get to use non-trivial deseparation relations. So if I study this DAG, I'll find that, for example, Y1 is deseparated from the triple B2, C1, Y2. So where's Y1? There's Y1. B2, C1, Y2. B2, C1, and Y2. Okay, so I have to make sure that they have no common ancestry. Well, all the paths from Y1 to C1 and B2 go through B1 here, which is a collider between Y1 and the other guys. And I'm not conditioning on B1, so I'm going to block those paths. If I look at the paths between Y1 and Y2, they either go through this collider or they're going to go through A1 or A2, which are also colliders on those paths. So yeah, I'm going to get that deseparation. And that's going to tell me that these guys are conditionally independent. These are just regular independence. I haven't gotten to the conditional independence yet. So these are just the kinds of independence we've been using up till now. So nothing new yet. I plug those in, I get this inequality. And now the point is that this guy here, after doing all these substitutions, I'm still left with something that isn't injectable. A1, C2, Y1. That's not the same as what I, it doesn't have the same ancestry here as it would in the original graph. So A1, Y1, and C2. So C2 doesn't have the same X parent as A1 does. So that, at this point it looks like I'm stuck, but the point is it is expressible now. It's just I have to go beyond these independences and start looking at conditional independences. So the idea is that, I have this deseparation relation here. A1 is deseparated from C2 given B1 and Y1. So let's see. A1, C2, and I'm conditioning on B1 and Y1. So Y1 is like a fork here. So it's going to make A1, it's going to block these paths between A1 and C2 because it's acting as a fork on those paths. And let's see, C2, A1, Y1, and B1, and I'm conditioning on B1 as well. So I guess B1 is a collider here, so it could have opened up this path. So conditioning on B1 blocks the direct path that doesn't go through Y, right? Because on this path, it's a mediary between A1 and Z, so it's going to block this path. And in principle, it would have opened up this path here because it's a collider on this path, but I'm also conditioning on Y1, which blocks that path. So if I condition on both of them, I get deseparation. If you go along other paths, like there are other paths between C2 and A1 that go sort of the long way around, but they're all going to be blocked as well. Anyways, you're going to get this decomposition now. So this is just a way of writing the conditional independence relation that follows from this. And it re-expresses the joint over these four variables in terms of joints, in terms of triples and a pair. And so I can take the marginal on A1, C2, Y1 of this guy. So I'm summing over B. So I just take this and I sum over B. And now I've plugged it back into my original inequality, the one I derived on the last slide. That's this term here. I've plugged in this guy here. And the point is that I'm back to things that are only on injectable sets, but I've had to use a deseparation relation. So the polynomial equality is a bit more complicated than the ones we had before. It's not just a factorization. But at the end of the day, I still get something that I can pull back to the original DAG, and it turns out that this inequality is in fact sufficient to show that this distribution is incompatible. Okay, maybe one other comment and then we can stop for the day, that there are more constraints you can use. Yes?
Sorry. It's easy to see whether a set is injectable or not, but to see if it's expressible,
yes,
I don't know, looks a bit more complicated. How can we? Because is there like a written way to see that?
Yeah, you can first find all the injectable sets, and then you could go and find all the deseparation relations, and then you could say which of these deseparation relations only involve the injectable sets.
Okay.
And then you will have found all your expressible sets. Okay, if I look at the spiral inflation and these triples, A1, A2, B1, A1, A2, B2, they're not injectable sets. They're not expressible sets either, because A1 and A2 are generally correlated, and so there's sort of nothing in the original graph that corresponds to it. But they do satisfy some extra equalities because of the definition of an inflation model. Remember that the definition of inflation model meant that, you know, every A depends on its parents in the same way. So in particular, because A1 depends on its parents the same way as A2 does, there's going to be this symmetry property of the joint distribution on A1, A2, B1, and A. Sorry. I said it wrong. I'm relying on the fact that B1 and B2 depend on their parents in the same way. And that's why if I evaluate the probability of this triple distribution on the value B and this one on the value B, they're going to be the same, right? So I'm just leveraging the fact that B1 and B2 are copy index equivalent. But it's also the case that if I have a permutation of the A's, so here or here, the only difference, like here, it's at the same triple. I think I screwed up this equation. Oh no, it looks fine. So this B2 in both cases, but here I'm looking at A1, A2, here I'm looking at A2, A1. And so all I've done is swap the values. That's also a valid equality just by the definition of an inflation model. And the thing is that these equalities can be added to the constraints you apply on the joint distribution that you're getting from the marginal problem. So at the very beginning of the lecture, I said, you can imagine a version of the marginal problem where you don't just ask, is there any old distribution that has these marginals, but is there some distribution with some extra properties? So I can throw symmetry properties in. And again, they're just, you know, equality constraints. So they're not going to make the problem you have to solve any harder. It's still just linear quantifier elimination. And so it doesn't change the complexity of the problem. And so sometimes, you know, using these kinds of constraints, you can get more. You can get, you know, stricter inequalities, because the more constraints you put in, the stricter your inequalities will be.
Why are they true? I don't understand. Why would these symmetries true?
So if I were to take the time to write out this expression, it would be something like, okay, the conditional probability of A1 given X1, Y1 times the conditional probability of A2 given x1, y2, times the conditional probability of b2 given y1, z2. And over here, I would have the same thing, the same sort of expression. And then when I plug in these different values, so here a is how I evaluate the a1 conditional, a prime is how I evaluate the a2 conditional. Here it's the reverse. But the point is that those conditionals, how A2 depends on its parents and how A1 depends on its parents, they're exactly the same functional form. And so if I put A, if I evaluate one on A and one on A prime, or vice versa, I'm going to get the same thing. So that's why this holds. And it's a similar logic for the other ones. I probably should have written that out explicitly. Okay, so the point is that, you know, relative to what we said before, I can now sort of soup up my linear inequalities for marginal compatibility by, you know, having this, you know, variant of the marginal problem where I ask for marginal compatibility subject to some extra symmetry constraints on the joint distribution. Doesn't change the fact that this is a linear quantifier elimination. So I can throw that in and get some slightly stronger polynomial inequalities. And for some problems, that's useful. Okay, and that's it for today. So I'm happy to take any more questions.
Are we gonna see some coding in this course, or is it?
That wasn't my intention. Like, the problem sets I was thinking would avoid asking you to write code to do any of this. I mean, if you wanted to, I could certainly suggest maybe some problems that, you know, would be interesting to solve from a research perspective. But yeah, we weren't thinking of doing that on the problem sets.
Before entropic inequality, this interesting technique. But so for that, isn't the original this thing quantified elimination already linear? So is the inflation giving us any other advantage? Or
can you ask the question again? I missed some of what you said.
We are using this inflation technique to come up with the entropic inequality.
Right, and you're asking, does it do more than what we saw last time with the Shannon cone?
Yes, is that, because the quantified elimination, those equations were already linear when we had when we expressed it in terms of entropies.
Yes, so in general, yes, you can get stronger entropic inequalities from here. Because again, it's a different quantifier elimination problem. So what we talked about last time was, we said, all right, we're gonna talk about entropies of the actual observed variables and the latent variables. So we're gonna have subsets that involve like a lambda and an a lambda and a b, things like that. And then we're gonna eliminate all the joint entropies that refer to any of those latent variables. Whereas in this, what we've talked about today, no latent variable appears in any of the parameters we're trying to eliminate. Instead, we just have versions of the observed variables, like A1, B1, C1, A2, B2, C2, and we're talking about joint entropies of them. So it's a very different set of parameters we're eliminating. And it turns out that you can get much stronger entropic constraints. So there's a lot of results that show that if you do take the Shannon cone as your outer approximation and you just do quantifier elimination associated with the latent variables, those tend to be pretty weak constraints, and they fail to see things like the W distribution being incompatible with a triangle, and there's only so much you can do with those sorts of techniques. There's more to say on that, but hopefully that maybe answers your question. Yes?
In the last lecture, you said that when you go to entropies, you're kind of losing some because there are a lot of probability distributions that use the same entropy.
Yes.
I thought that here with inflation we were finding inequalities on the probability distributions, even the ones that are not entropic inequalities. That's not the case.
Well, you can do both things. So like earlier in the talk I gave examples where you can derive entropic or regular. Let me go all the way back.
Yes.
So this was my example of an entropic one, but I can also use inflation to derive constraints on the correlators, which for binary variables are just like the probability distributions.
Yes.
So, maybe what I didn't emphasize was that in the case where A, B, and C are binary, you know, this is definitely, it's better to use the correlators or the joint distributions rather than the entropies, because you're throwing away less information. But if I tell you every one of these variables has 100 values, well, you know, working in terms of the probability distribution becomes really hard. But I can still use the entropies. These entropic inequalities I derive for you hold regardless of the cardinality of A, B, and C. So yeah, if you're focused on binary case, you might say, oh, well, this is too coarse-grained for my liking. It's not refined enough. It's not giving me all the information. But if you're in a different problem space, you might say, well, I have no hope of finding the more fine-grained constraints, and I'll be happy to have constraints like this that I can actually get some information out of. So you know, the entropic constraints, like, you know, this one, but also ones that follow from like the spiral inflation and other inflations, you know, they're maybe still strong enough to rule out some distributions that the Shannon cone techniques that we saw last time could not do. They can still be really useful in some situations, yeah. Okay, well, let's end there for today.